Welcome to the Untangling Web3 podcast. Today, we're diving deep into DeepIn, Decentralized Physical Infrastructure Networks, with one of its leading voices. Tom Trowbridge is the co-founder of Fluence, a decentralized computing platform building the cloudless internet, offering enterprise-grade, low-cost, and resilient compute. Before that, he helped launch Hedera Hashgraph, serving as its president from inception and shaping it into a top blockchain project. Tom is also a major force in the DeepIn space, hosting the DeepIn podcast, organizing DeepIn Day conferences, and investing in leading DeepIn projects and Web3 funds. Today, we'll explore the rise of DeepIn, its impact on infrastructure, and what the future holds. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, so I saw you speaking at ETH Denver. You had a DeepIn side event with Fluence, and I was very impressed. I was like, we have to get this guy on the show. DeepIn is something that's coming up more and more in the conversation, and you explain it in such a tangible and understandable way, especially when we're talking about decentralized technologies. It gets so confusing so quickly. So yeah, I'm really excited for this one.
Listen, super appreciated. And you know, what you saw me at was what we call DeepIn Day. And that was, it's basically a series of DeepIn focused side conferences. That was our 10th. So it is, I hope after 10, I can explain it somewhat well. Definitely had enough practice, I would think. But so slowly getting there. But glad, thanks for attending and for the compliments.
Yeah, that's interesting. So is that 10 as in 10 years, or is that 10 that's been kind of shorter?
10 years. What's been around 10 years? It feels like 10 years.
I was going to say, yeah.
Nothing's been around 10 years except for Bitcoin. Yeah. No, we did one. I mean, we've done those at most of the big crypto events. So we started, our first one was ETH Denver last year. So it's just been a year. But then we were Token 24/9. We were at ECC in Brussels. We were at DevCon in Bangkok. We were at Korea Blockchain Week, right? So we've done, you know, a lot of the big ones we've done these side events at. And this year, the first one was in Hong Kong at Consensus. And then the second one was ETH Denver. We're doing another one at the Dubai Token 24/9, the Singapore Token 24/9, and probably DevCon in Buenos Aires. So anyone interested in DeepIn, you know, these I think are far and away the most regular leading kind of place where we kind of want to make it a community event and gather as many founders, investors, and ecosystem kind of people as we can to kind of explore and stay current on what's going on.
Awesome. You're a very busy man, clearly, then. Yeah, I just wanted to double check that for context, because I was like, okay, have I missed 7 or 8 years of this DeepIn conversation now? I hope I haven't. But yeah, that's good.
So, right.
Yeah, for me, this is a very new term. I've been seeing it pop up more and more over the last couple of years. So yeah, why don't we just start there with kind of grounding us in this concept. So what exactly is DeepIn? Can you give us a kind of LE5 explanation and why it kind of matters?
Yeah, sure. So listen, it's the right question. I on the podcast I host, I literally ask founders first to define DeepIn because it's gotten a little bit of attention, and so a lot of projects are now trying to kind of be DeepIn, and so I think we got to kind of a definition, or else it becomes meaningless. And so definition that I'm working with is crowdsourced physical infrastructure that is put together in a network, providing a useful service secured and incented by crypto economics. And so that is, I think that's a core piece of DeepIn. And what is physical, like what is crowdsourced hardware mean? That can be a phone, it can be a server, it can be a router, it can be a camera, dash cam on your car, it could be an antenna that shares Wi-Fi from your home. It could be even a browser extension that you download to share bandwidth, right? It could be a weather station that you buy and share outside your home, right? So there's a whole manner of different types of hardware. And I think the thing that distinguishes DeepIn is that the company, the project, isn't buying this hardware. So think of it as if an Uber or an Airbnb, but right, they don't buy the hardware. Right. That's all the drivers supply the cars, the homeowners supply the homes. And that's kind of the DeepIn model, with the distinction that instead of, if you're an Uber driver, you're paid in cash, fine, same Airbnb. But as that company grows, all that happens to you as a driver or you as a homeowner is you get more competition, right? So you don't benefit. Maybe there's more people looking for you, but there's also more supply. So do you benefit? I don't know. But in the Deepin space, you're paid in tokens. And if that project succeeds, those tokens should become much more valuable. So you actually participate in the upside of that. And the other part is that unlike Airbnb and Uber, those are consumer-focused businesses, right? They are building brands that they need lots of people to use. Most Deepin projects are focused on providing a service or collecting data that is then sold to businesses. So you don't have this massive marketing spend and this massive marketing need that you do in those centralized companies I mentioned. And the third point is that a lot of Deepin is what I call set and forget, where you put a camera in your car, you download a browser extension, you put an app on your phone, you put an antenna outside, and you don't think about it anymore. There's no more maintenance or very little occasionally. Very different than you're an Uber driver in Airbnb. You got to drive every day. You've got to make sure the house is in. You got to turn people over, right? It takes effort and work. And so you have a lot of turnover. And so the set it and forget it model means you got less turnover in the actual participants of the network, which also means they need to be paid less, which makes the whole system work. So anyway, that's a very kind of long explanation of Deepin, but trying to put it in the context of the businesses that people see and interact with every day.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you kind of touched on some of the current centralized infrastructure, like models and setups. I think it's always good to compare what you're trying to replace with the system that you're proposing. And so like kind of, you mentioned there that you're saying lots of people have these additional resources that they don't need and they can contribute to these systems. Is that the kind of the assumption we're going in with? And could you talk us through, say, some kind of examples that would bring it home? You mentioned like things like Uber as being an example, but what's something that will make someone understand how this stuff is tangible?
Yeah, sure. So I guess there's, you know, there's a couple different categories. And the main two categories are the cloud Deepins. And then there are what I call sort of the physical, or not me, but Masari also calls the physical Deepins. And the cloud Deepins are providing services like storage, compute, rendering, file rendering. Those, I think, are a little different and much, they're more cloud services, which are not as tangible for people to understand. I think those are going to be enormous successes. That's Filecoin. It's what Fluence does. We could talk about it. It's what Render does. It's what Arweave does. So we can get into that in a minute. Let's focus on the physical ones because those are easier to understand. And those are ones like an example of one of kind of a leading project is, you know, HiveMapper. HiveMapper has designed and sells pretty much at cost a dash camera for a car. And so that consumers buy that camera for $300-$500, I think, or something along those lines. It's installed in their car, always on, and that takes video of the roads. They aggregate all that data, all that video, and they end up having a far more up-to-date, current mapping of those regions, of those areas that are mapped, than Google Earth does, and Google Street View, sorry. So they end up having a more updated map that costs them zero CapEx because all the participants are buying those cameras, right? So they don't actually have to fund that CapEx. And so they then are able to sell that data, effectively those images, to a wide number of businesses. And then they use that to basically invest in the token and make those token rewards valuable. So that's an example of it. If you have that camera, you put it in and that's it. You don't have to think about it. Now, occasionally they'll say, hey, if you want to earn more rewards, go drive over here. We're trying to map this, et cetera. There's another one I like, and this one, the token hasn't launched yet. It's called Spexy, and they do drone mapping of the world. And the cool thing about this is that it's like 3 or 4 times more resolution than a Google Earth. And it can be mapped in cloudy weather. And they can map it with like a couple days turnaround. So you end if you, and it's cheaper. So if you start to compound all those things, it's like 3 or 4 times better resolution. You can map it in a couple days as opposed to a month. And it can be done in cloudy weather and it's cheaper. So it's like a massive more compelling offering. than what a centralized company has. And so they're basically knocking down city after city doing this. And you just take a commercial drone, you get a hex and you put your camera in it, and it flies automatically and maps automatically. So you don't have to pilot it, right? You just sort of send it up and it goes. So that's an example. Again, they are not buying the drones. They're not buying the cameras. They are just out there providing the software tools that allow people to go out and do that and map that. And they aggregate all that data and then they sell it to all kinds of different providers who want it. And I can keep going. There's people that sell, you know, weather locations. They have more updated weather. People install those in their houses. That's WeatherXM. There's GeoNet. I talk about in this report I can mention that does RTK positioning, which is basically 1 centimeter precise positioning. So 100 times more precise than a GPS, right? That company has double the amount of coverage of the biggest centralized company. And they do it for cheaper, and they've done it for no CapEx. So those are some examples of kind of real services that are offered and businesses are actually buying.
Okay, interesting. I mean, you've given so many interesting examples there. I'm glad you mentioned Hive Mapper, because as you were describing Deepin in general to start with, I was kind of thinking, oh yeah, I guess, you know, that sounds a little bit like what Google Earth did and Google Street View, except it was controlled by a single company. So for so many of us, our view of the entire world has been dominated by the lens of this single centralized company for many years, right? So yeah, I can see an immediate benefit in kind of crowdsourcing that to local people, effectively, or people who actually live there. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Just on a key point, if I had gone out and Hive Mapper or any of these companies gone out, guess what? I want to compete with Google. I need to buy X number of devices. People would have said, we're not going to fund that, right? No venture capitalist would have funded someone to compete with Google Earth, whatever. But when you don't have to do that, instead the community does it, now you can come up with it. And I would argue that that's true a whole bunch of spaces. The only way to compete with these huge companies is if the crowd does it. Because individually, it's just so expensive. And Google has effectively unlimited resources. Mm-hmm. But if you've got a crowd doing it, now you have a chance.
Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. That's a really nice segue into kind of the question I want to ask you then is, so we've mentioned already in our distinction between, you know, Deepin and traditional kind of centralized infrastructure, this role of tokens, right? And when we say tokens, obviously we're talking about, you know, blockchain and crypto tokens, essentially. So in your mind, how much of the importance of that is weighted on the kind of individual ownership, or is it the medium exchange, or is it what you said about how you actually fund these projects and get them off the ground? Like, where do you see the role of tokens as important in this whole movement, and could Deepin exist without them, to be frank? Like, that'd be an interesting kind of thought experiment, I think, as well.
So that I think is fascinating. So I guess the way I address this, I'd step back for 1 second and say Deepin exists today and not 5 years ago at scale because of the convergence of three things. Convergence of hardware price decline, which you could either call price decline / functionality increase, right? The stuff you have on your phone, the sensors on your phone are dramatically different than they were even 5 years ago. And that allows you to collect a lot more data than possible and far cheaper. So hardware price decline, and then software availability. The open source software world now allows you to have the pieces to put together networks at scale that, again, were not possible about 5 years ago, far cheaper, far more resilient, far more just competitive with centralized businesses. And then the third piece, which you mentioned, is the crypto economics. And this has to do with the scale of the crypto economics world and people's kind of comfort and understanding of it. And so you need the convergence of all three of those things for Deepin to exist. And the crypto piece is critical because without the crypto piece, you don't have the reward mechanism to incent people to go do stuff. So even if if there was no crypto world and I wanted to buy that Hive Mapper camera or Helium router or whatever it is, I would need to be able to, I would have to understand that I would get revenue from that. And the problem is that as a company, I'd either have to raise a huge amount of money, even if I didn't buy the CapEx, to go fund the return on that CapEx. Problem one. Mm-hmm. Right. And so crypto, and at some point, the rewards and the revenue I'm generating from that data should be sufficient so I could just pay people. But there's two problems with that. One, I have to bridge this period of time when I'm collecting all this data before I have customers, right? And that can be years. So that's point number one. And point number two is I'm only rewarding people then with some level of fiat if I raise a ton of money, and there's no way to help them participate in the upside of the network, right? I can't give shares to everybody. Our security system just doesn't work like that. So even if I had raised a ton of money, I'm now paying people in some amount of dollars that might be okay, but that's it. And that is doesn't really inspire there's no hope. There's no drive. That's not nearly the same incentive as if I'm getting stuff at a dollar, but I think this token, if this network works, is worth 10, right? You've got a different thing. And so a different conception. And so it can work without crypto. Don't get me wrong. It just requires a lot of capital to be invested to bridge that gap before you get to the actual revenue scale of the network.
Okay, so you're saying it's like one part, the efficiency, the ability to send small micropayments, payment streaming style per device, but also the community participation to get people invested kind of ethically in the project as well. Like one thing I noticed at ETH Denver was the number of new tokens being launched for every project. Is this something you're seeing as well? Do you think like a lot of these DPM projects have to have their own token, or do you think the siloing effect is not so good? What's your kind of take on that?
I think you have to have your own token, really? Because otherwise you're run into the same problem of where are you getting the funds to pay people? If you want to pay people in some other token, you got to get that somewhere. You got to buy it, right? So it's the same as if it's fiat. And so you need to have, and so you need to have the ability to, and you also have to have the ability for people who like that project to be able to participate in that via the token. If you don't, then you know you're back to a fiat world.
That makes sense. So you're an advocate of this kind of idea that we're going to have lots of different token projects per everything we use, rather than the one or two tokens ruling the world kind of idea that people used to tout.
Yeah, without a doubt. Now, just to give a sense of scale here, I think the latest number I saw was about 33 million tokens out there right now. And I think 600,000 I've read launched in January and about the same in February. So it is good. You know, we're entering a world of crazy proliferation because it's so easy to do. But that then goes back to token economics of, okay, what will drive interest and what will drive actual value in the tokens. And this is why I just recently released my DPIN token economics report, where I kind of dig into the different building blocks of a proper DPIN token economics. And I think DPIN does things differently than most other crypto projects in trying, and not trying to, but effectively tying revenue to token price, so that you can actually say, if this project generates 1 million, 10 million, 20 million of revenue, I know how that's going to impact the token. That's not clear in almost every other type of crypto project, with some exceptions here and there, of course, but generally that's not the case. And so I think that is going to lead DPIN, this is sort of fast forward, to decouple from the rest of the crypto market and actually perform differently, better or worse. It's, you know, my joke, it's not a meme, right? So memes can go up unlimited, right? We've seen it, and they also go down. I think DPIN is going to be decouple as revenue starts to kick in.
I'm glad you, like, when I saw you do the talk, I found that like a really important insight that I hadn't thought about before. Like these magic money projects that you say, the meme coins, it's so hard to understand what makes them tick and how they gain value, because the value is kind of quite arbitrary and finger in the air depending on what one person says over here. But when you're talking about DPIN projects, the ones you were describing, it's really easy and tangible the actual product itself and the value add, the physical hardware connection to link it to something that's real. It's not just for like us crypto natives, but also the, all the people that are onboarding now, hopefully in the future. And like to that, I want to talk about your main project. So we've talked a little bit about all the many physical DeepIn projects that exist, but let's talk about cloud DeepIn. Can you tell us a little bit about Fluence? I know the term you used in the talk was the cloudless internet. Can you talk a little bit about the motivation behind that and what you're trying to do with Fluence?
Yes. So if you think, I guess, about the internet overall, it has become quite centralized. And there are some people out there who say, oh, it's broken. It's not broken. It works great. People use it all the time. We're only using it more. So nothing is broken. But at the same time, there are about five companies that control 60 to 70% of it. And so that means if you're out there using it, you are dependent on Amazon, Google, Microsoft Azure, or like Tencent and Alibaba, right? Like that's about it. And so that's where almost everything happens. And so if, and the thing for people to understand is that even this whole blockchain world that we live in, most of blockchain nodes run in the centralized cloud, right? Yeah. Infura, a key kind of building block project runs in the centralized cloud. And so we can be as happy as proud as we want about all of the consensus algorithms that are out there and the choice we have and how decentralized they are. But if you have 60% of your validators, your nodes running in Amazon or in Google, and then there's a regulatory decision or a country, whatever, that's no longer appropriate, bang. And you got a problem. And so I think luckily we're less of a problem in the US than we were a couple months ago, but that risk is still there. And so I think that is a big piece of why we need to, and on top of that, why you need decentralization. On top of that, it's more expensive. And on top of that, than it needs to be, it also is closed in a way that if I want to transfer my data or my compute from Azure to Amazon, that is a very difficult, very complicated, expensive, and risky process. So not something people like to do. So you end up in these closed ecosystems, and that does not lead to great innovation. And so what we've done is we do have decentralized payments, which is sort of Bitcoin, Ethereum, et cetera, even though some of that runs on the cloud for sure, still better than a centralized payment process. And there's decentralized storage with Filecoin, Arweave, and others. Compute and is the last piece that hasn't been decentralized at scale. And deep compute is the actual work of that make everything run, right? If you're doing a Netflix search, like the math behind figuring out that movie, or if you're doing your Uber calculation, Uber is doing calculation of how much a ride is going to cost and where the car is coming from, right? All of that stuff happens in the centralized cloud. And so Fluence is building the cloudless internet, which is basically a platform of decentralized compute that doesn't rely on the centralized cloud. And the confusing part is we still use top tier data centers. And so this is not relying on individuals' home computers. We decided from the beginning to start off and make this as enterprise grade as we could. So we started with six providers that are in top tier data centers, the same one the top Web2 companies use, and that are very resilient. That makes the technical problems for us easier to solve. And it also lets our customers know that it's much more understandable because it's not the problem of a lot of, you know, computers around people's houses. And but it's open. And that means if I'm using it and I'm using a provider, I'm like, you know what, this guy's cheaper now, or I like this one more, it's better location or whatever it is, I can shift like this. And so you have an open network where you can move from one compute provider to another as you choose. And the other piece of that, besides giving control to the user, you get more innovation is possible. But the other point is you're always going to have price competed down, because if someone tries to raise price or is higher price, customers can easily move to another one. And so I think that will put a ceiling on price. And so we think that Fluence is around depending on kind of the scale you use and the duration, you know, up to about 70% cheaper than centralized cloud offerings. And so that is, this is not a 10% savings. So, right, it's a material savings. And on top of that, you get the openness, the censorship resistance, et cetera. So we think this is important. It is, I think, we don't expect to displace the cloud. That is not going away. It's easy to use. It is not going to end. But that is a vast market. And even having the offering of this helps the resilience of the internet overall and of applications and of companies, et cetera. So that is what we're doing. And, you know, we launched the token last year in February, about a year ago. We have launched the network. We are in beta right now with our first customer batch. And we're, you know, working to onboard these customers, you know, this week, next week, by the time this is on, probably have the customers onboarded. And so, you know, just kind of trying to get that scaled.
Today's episode is sponsored by the VeChain Foundation.
Now, we often talk about how emerging technologies like blockchain have the potential to revolutionize sustainability. And VeChain is at the forefront of this green movement with initiatives like VBetterDAO. Let's take a closer look.
Imagine tracking small actions like recycling at low cost, making them valuable assets. These verified records build a massive collective impact, benefiting people through their own actions. Sound a bit complex, but VeChain made it fun. Explore our apps at vbetter.com.
VeChain's goal is to power a new era of sustainable solutions. So if you've got an app idea or just want to earn rewards for small, sustainable actions every day, go check out vbetterdao.com to find out more. And now back to the show.
I love this topic because I think that there's a lot of interesting things going on. You mentioned, you know, Filecoin. I think IPFS was one of the first things that I kind of got excited about because it's that decentralizing storage for the internet. But yet the compute thing, how do we solve that has been, you know, a much bigger challenge in my mind. And it kind of reminds me actually of almost Bitcoin mining in a way, like in the sense that that is a very small computational, the field of that computation is very narrow, right? It's a very specific task that we're asking to do in a way, but it's distributed. And the way mining pools work, people can point their individual hash power at, you know, different providers. So I think there's a kind of analogy there. Obviously, it's not a perfect one here. That's a simple computational challenge in Bitcoin in theory. What's the big technical challenge, if there is one, that you had to overcome in building Fluence? Because, you know, it sounds like a very difficult thing. And I'm also wondering in that same kind of question, who are the actual network participants in your model? Because when you mentioned kind of enterprise grade, now that kind of is a different thing I'm thinking about from when we talked about, you know, the Hive mapping use case. So yeah, could you talk to that a little bit?
Right. Well, okay. There's a lot there. Let's take it first in terms of participants. That's easier. So, we have started with providers at top tier data centers. So these are people, these are companies that run, compute, they run servers, they own servers in kind of very resilient, what we call tier four data centers around the world. So these are professional data center providers. They're not the hyperscalers I mentioned before. They're much smaller ones. And usually these guys have some excess compute. And so as long as you are covering the cost of their electricity, you are adding value to that excess compute. So that's sort of point one. At some point, I think they'll be buying hardware, and there's even the potential for us to crowdsource this hardware as well from people that want to own hardware and participate. So we think that's a possibility as well. But for right now, it's excess compute hardware, and we have a long list of providers who want to add a lot of hardware so that the supply is not the issue at all. There's plenty of supply of high quality hardware in very resilient data centers. That's easy. Now, in terms of the problem, I guess the first way to articulate this is, you know, it's a hard problem because no one else, because all the compute's hanging out is running in data centers and is running in by the hyperscalers, and there's no other projects out there doing this. And so What you do have, first, on the decentralized compute landscape, there are many people doing this with marketplaces for GPUs. And let's just distinguish this for a second. GPUs are very important. They are the graphic processing units. They are the NVIDIA machines that train AI, right? AI demand is growing significantly, and there's a whole kind of nuances of the GPU market that leads there to be, despite high demand, also excess that some of these providers are able to aggregate and monetize. And that is a terrific market. It's only going to grow. But where we are CPUs, which are the work of 95 or 99% of the internet. You know, there are billions of CPUs that have been sold, and they do all the work that's not AI. And that is a lot, right? It's everything from the examples I mentioned to, if you want to sequence a genome, or you want to, you know, do drug discovery, you want all this stuff, right? You know, you want to search for flights, all this stuff is happening in CPU. So that's where we're focused. And then, and that remains centralized because the marketplace component of that is difficult. So if I want to just rent a machine, that's one level of complexity, but then I have to be able to plug into that machine. The ports have to work. I have to know what, you know, what software I'm running. And the more complex an operation you want to run, the more software tools are required. And the more those software tools are probably specific to that use case or that sector. And so we started off with quite a relatively simple solution, which still isn't simple, but simpler, which is basically a virtual machine. And so a virtual machine allows you to rent a kind of an arbitrary amount of compute. And that by itself is more complex than just renting a box. And so the virtual machine offering we have, I think we're first, second or so to do that. And then from there, we're going to go to the next level, which is service level agreements, SLAs. And what SLAs are, is they're basically guarantees of performance. Mm-hmm. And to have a guarantee of performance, that is kind of what unlocks the scalability here. And the reason we haven't seen those before is if you're, most people who've tried this approach have done it with people's home hardware. And the problem with an SLA there is that you need bandwidth to be on, the machine has to be on. If it's not, you have to have failover to somebody else quite easily. Those are a lot of hard things to offer, and you can't reliably do that with individual participants. But if we have data centers as a part of this, the provider can certify, the data center can certify, and then we can. And so that is, I think, going to make it much easier. And once you have SLAs, you then unlock proper businesses who can now purchase this in a way they were never before able to do. Because if things went down, the first thing the boss would ask is, well, what's the SLA? Oh, I didn't have an SLA. Mm-hmm. Why did you not have an SLA? Right. So like you can see that. So The SLA piece is the critical unlock to scale. And that's easier for us given the data center providers that we have. And so that's where we're heading, a little bit later this year.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, so what is like, is there a target market for Fluence right now? Because at first I thought it was maybe smaller companies, but now you're talking about more institution style SLA stuff. Is there a target market or is it everyone?
No. So we're super specific and focused right now on third-party node providers or node hosts. Okay. So if you're a consumer and you want someone to run a node for you in a particular project, you go to a whole number of companies. And so those companies right now generally use a centralized cloud. We're a lot cheaper. It's a simpler offering. And it's that margin we save them, they can take. So it's super simple for them to appreciate that value, and it's decentralized. And it's also the type of business where with a couple companies do it, they're more competitive than the other ones, right? So you kind of then, I think, will kind of drive the industry to adopt it. So that's our whole pipeline is focused just on that sector right now. Once we've reached the SLA, once we've kind of implemented SLAs, that opens up a wider segment of businesses. And then we target kind of another, the next kind of segment. And we're exploring a couple of those right now, but we haven't decided which one. But we want to remain very focused on this third-party node providers for the next at least probably 6 months or so until we've really kind of scaled in that vertical.
I mean, that's the perfect use case, right? And like you say, it's an absolute booming market. There's a network everywhere today. And the need for them to be decentralized and open, like, it perfectly aligns. So it makes a lot of sense. The next thing I want to ask you about, and we've talked about Fluence, is the podcast. Like, I want to know, you know, why you decided to start that, how it's kind of gone, like, because, you know, we're obviously on a podcast right now. What's the education piece been like around, like, Deepin generally?
Well, yeah, for those that don't know, the podcast is right behind me, Deepin. And so I'm a newbie at this, but I'm probably 46, 47 episodes in. And I just felt that there was no knowledgeable kind of focused podcast on Deepin. And I felt the space was very new and that I knew enough about it and I was interested enough about it and all the projects that I could get out and talk to people, and that would be potentially interesting again to a small segment, but that is also a bet on the whole industry growing. And so I've just enjoyed it because the issue with being a founder of a project is you can get very kind of focused on what you're doing and not see kind of a broader ecosystem around you. And so you always found you end up being much more laser focused on what you're doing, as you should be. This helps me get a broader sense into all the stuff happening in the sector, which I love. And plenty of these companies are potential partners for Fluence. Also, many of these projects are exploring the same problems we are with token economics, with building business development teams, you know, with expansion. So it is just a way to kind of connect more broadly, and I hope bring awareness to this sector overall.
I listened to a couple of the episodes, and it's clear how passionate and knowledgeable you are. Which, I mean, very in the space, obviously. Whereas me and Jack, we just talk about a lot of random things that we know nothing about. So it's a very different angle. But we learn so much from it. What are some of, like, is there a couple of things or one thing that really stood out for you, a project or an insight that you've taken from the podcast that's really blown you away a little bit?
I guess I'd say a couple of things is that I think the sector is different. In that what a lot of people do here, and this gets back to your very first question, is they're domain experts in particular areas that then have stumbled on crypto as a way to help them execute or scale the business they know well best. And that's very different. And so it's like, okay, I'm really experienced in weather, in RTK, and whatever, I'm deep in this, or you know, 4K mapping or whatever it is. And now I've somehow stumbled on crypto and realized I can build a network way cheaper, better, and can do that. And that this is the way to do it. And so that is different than a lot of crypto, which is people who find this technology and then look for ways to deploy this technology. This is more, what I find Deepin is more the reverse. It's like, I've got a product and now I figured out a way that crypto and blockchain can help me execute and scale this product, which is, I think, ultimately how it should be. And so that I see that is something I've seen many, many times, and that I find interesting. I'd also say that the token economics piece, I think, is interesting. And that's why I wrote a report on it. Because there's a wide range of people who've thought about it a lot and others who haven't. And I think that is going to have to be a big, big focus. And it's going to differentiate projects down the road, as those who really, you know, can scale revenue and have linked that revenue to the token. I think that is going to make a big difference. And that is, you know, early projects did not do a good job of that. Later ones have. And I think that is going to continue to be a real focus for sure. All these projects, with a couple exceptions, are small, right? Very small. But I think this is, but it's a big space. It's growing. And I think you're going to see some big successes come out of this over the next kind of 2 years.
Yeah, that's a nice outlook. And I think, you know, from my impression, it's quite refreshing that Deepin seems to lend itself to putting utility first, right? As you said, it's like there's a problem to solve, and the whole space is oriented around how do we solve that problem? And is crypto and tokenomics a good tool to help us do that, right? It starts with trying to sell yourself on, is this a problem worth solving? Can we solve it? And then the tokenomics comes in and the technology, which is pretty much the reverse, as you said, of lots of other things in the wider space. So that's it. That's really refreshing. Tom, it's been a really fun conversation. Obviously, we'll link the Deepin report that you've just released in the episode notes. But can you just give our audience a little preview of, you know, what can they expect from that? And, you know, what's this outlook for the future? What is it kind of predicting or expecting to see us talking about in the next couple of years?
Well, listen, I appreciate that. And I'd also say, you know, if we're doing a Deepin day in Dubai. So for anyone at Token 2049, May 1st, we'll be doing something. So if that works for people, hope to see you in person. So come to that. And then with regard to the report, you know, I just wanted to do this because I feel that a lot of reports out there, there've been a number on Deepin, talk about the projects, talk about the services, and that's really important. But token economics is very rarely discussed. And I think that is something that's really important in the Deepin space. And my thesis is that you're going to see traditional investors interested by the revenue that Deepin starts to generate, Deepin projects start to generate. And when the traditional investors start to look, and by the way, traditional investors are like 100 times bigger than the crypto space right now. So we want that to happen. And when they start to look, they're going to have a very different perspective and a much higher bar for what is appropriate in terms of clarity and in terms of precision, in terms of how revenue works and earnings and how things flow to tokens. And so I thought it's important to kind of unpack all this, both for founders to understand all the pieces that they're designing, because plenty of projects are going to launch this year and haven't launched, lots. And then also for investors who are presented with a project to help understand all the different pieces and how they work together. And so I tried to make it super specific and use examples of where the token use comes in from and how it differs from cloud versus physical DPINs and token generation. And what do people take fiat, for example, and not just paying token? I think you got to take fiat in order to scale. There's a whole number of sort of obvious points, but I think just need to be kind of put together in one place. And I think you're ultimately going to see, you know, a couple token models converge around the obvious points, which is taking fiat, which is using almost all of your revenue to buy and burn your token if you have it. If you're a cloud Deepin, you're going to require stake, and the stake should be in your token, and the stake should be dollar based in your token, not just an arbitrary number of tokens. And then how you generate rewards is also fascinating. And that is how you pay people, right? Is it everyone gets the same amount? Do you run contests? You know, and that really depends based on the scale of people you're rewarding. And then how does governance work? Is it just one token, one vote? Is it scaled? Is it, you know, are there councils that can veto it, right? There's lots of things to unpack and dig into here. And I just think we're going to get to a stage where people focus more on that, and the projects that get it right are really a premium. And that's what I'm excited to see. And I think that's really the future.
Awesome. Fantastic, Tom. Yeah, definitely check out the report. It'll be linked in the description. And yeah, Tom, all that's left to do is just to thank you for your time. It's been a really, really interesting conversation. And to those listening at home, thank you for listening. You can join us next time to untangle a little more Web3.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Untangling Web3.
Don't forget to send us your thoughts, questions, and comments on social media. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast provider to catch the next episode. See you next time to untangle a little bit more of Web3.
The views we express here are our own and do not reflect the views of our employers.